right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And opening the show up, I'm very happy to be getting back into the interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Now, I did a five-part interview a little while ago. This is part three. And in this part of the interview, Avakian is talking about where are the forces who are going to make this revolution, where are they going to come from? So without any further ado, let's just jump right in to Bob Avakian being interviewed by me, Michael Slate. I was going back and forth on whether I was going to do this, and I really want to do it, and so we'll see what happens with this. Because exactly what you're saying in terms of this BA Everywhere campaign and all the stuff that you've been saying about the strategy and how we can get to this point where revolution isn't crazy but actually is seen as possible and is seen as something that people are taking up and fighting for in many different ways, there's a point that comes out of the forces to do this, that you actually do need to bring these people forward. And I know part of this campaign around the BA Everywhere is actually bringing forward cores of people who will do this, particularly among the people, you know, the people on the bottom of society who will be like the backbone of this revolution, but also among other sections of people as well. And I wanted to explore that, just if we can do it just briefly, even it'd be really good, I think, because this is one of the quotes that people from both the bottom of society as well as more middle class people really had to wrestle with. It really struck them, and I think it says something about when people talk about where are you going to get these forces in society. And this quote is, people say, you mean to tell me that these youth running around selling drugs and killing each other and caught up in all kinds of other stuff can be a backbone of the revolutionary state power in the future? Yes, but not as they are now and not without struggle. They weren't always selling drugs and killing each other and the rest of it, and they don't have to be into all that in the future. Ask yourself, how does it happen that you go from beautiful children to supposedly irredeemable monsters in a few years? It's because of the system and what it does to people, not because of unchanging and unchangeable human nature. And I think that really is something very important in relation to where are these forces going to come from? They're going to come from the very people that oftentimes are condemned, you know, or demonized, as you put it in other places, demonized, and as they're not only not fit to be, you know, ruled, you know, part of ruling the future society, but they're not fit to be even walk on the streets today. You know, and I think this question of transformation in terms of these forces that will be brought forward to be part of this revolution.
Well, you know, I was thinking, I've said this before, that when I went into exile in France in the early 1980s, I met someone from Asia who was a revolutionary-minded person, and one of the first things they said to me was, what's happening with black people in America? What's happening to their struggle? It seems like the imperialists have been able to contain them and suppress them. So what's the deal there? It looks like they're not, you know, revolutionary the way they were just a few years ago, and that this has all been crushed. And I said, well, maybe maybe in the short run and for the time being, but don't be too sure about the longer term. Because and it's not just black people, but this is one of the most concentrated forms of the oppressive nature of this whole system from its very beginning and down to today, the way in which it has treated and oppressed the masses of black people. And there are others in similar conditions, immigrants and forced into the margins and brutally exploited under the system, Latinos and others in the inner cities of the U.S. as well as people in other sections of society whose exploitation is increasing and whose conditions are becoming more difficult, or who are becoming in a broader sense aware of some of the workings of the system, for example, once again, with regard to the effect on the environment, and becoming concerned about that as well as learning about some of the other ways in which this system creates all kinds of atrocities and enforces all kinds of suffering. But people have said, well, where do you think the forces are going to, for example, when I did the interview with Cornel West that you referred to, he asked me at one point, whom do you see as being the sort of the basic driving force of this revolution? And I said, well, now, you know the answer to that, and I know the answer to that, and the ruling class of this country knows the answer to it, too. That's why they've got a war on drugs, which is a war on poor people, and why they've got this mass incarceration and other forms of degrading and oppressing people. And when we've gone out to people in these situations, precisely the kind of people that are spoken to in that quote from Basics that you just read, you know, the youth who have been caught up in crime and gangs and drugs and other things, or, you know, women who have been forced into all kinds of degrading conditions. When we've gone out to these people, you know, the point, the basic message about revolution deeply resonates with a lot of people, but then they raise the same things a lot of other people raise about the difficulties and how could we actually do this. And look what we're all caught up in. Even people who are caught up in this mess know that it's not good, know that it's not really what they want to be doing. And so they raise the question themselves, how can we break out of this? And this is a difficult contradiction because the conditions that people are caught up in, the fact that there are no decent jobs. I was talking to someone the other day and they said, look, you know, when I brought up the situation in Spain, we were talking about other countries and how the economic crisis hit them even worse. And the fact that, as I understand it, for people 25 and under in Spain today, the unemployment rate is 50%. And it's something like 30% for the whole society. Obviously, these are conditions that cry out for revolution, and they're one of the things that's lacking there and needs to be is a communist core that can actually lead this in a revolutionary direction. But as I was talking about this with this person, they brought up, yeah, well, that's, you know, it's very stark and terrible. But in many of the inner city communities, black and Latino communities, the unemployment rate for the youth in particular is even higher than that. Sometimes it's 75 or 90%. So, you know, in these kind of conditions, and as I point out before, it is not these youth who have been forced into these conditions. It's not they who took the jobs away. It's not they who created the unemployment rates that we're talking about. It's not they who, for example, closed down the huge U.S. steel plant in Gary, Indiana, which used to employ directly or indirectly tens of thousands of people, and have turned Gary into a ghost town with huge unemployment and drugs rampant and people suffering terribly, or you can look at Detroit and a similar kind of thing. It is not the people in those inner cities who are suffering in those conditions and responding to them. It is not they who created those conditions. And this is one of the things that, first of all, it's very important for people to understand. That's what that quote you read in other parts of Basics and our whole overall work, including through our newspaper Revolution, as well as other works of mine, talks and writings, are bringing out. It's very important for people, including the people most directly caught up in and subjected to this, you know, to these conditions. It's very important for them to understand that this is not something of their own doing, because it's constantly preached to them, including by the, you know, Obama, as I referred to earlier, that it is their own fault, that it is their own personal responsibility. It's very important for them to understand, you know, not just in an abstract sense that this is not their fault, but what are the actual workings of a system here that has put them in this position, and what is the actual real alternative to break out of this? You know, and I've used this example before. There are important things going on where people who have been condemned as the worst of the worst and, you know, thugs who are subhuman, who deserve, as you said, not even to be on the streets or not even to live in some people's eyes, let alone to be the backbone of a revolution and of a new revolutionary society. Very important things going on. For example, there have been the hunger strikes in California in prisons, including people in the most desperate and difficult conditions in those prisons within the last year. And some of these hunger strikers have now made a very important call for peace among people of different races in the prisons. And this is a tremendously important thing and also a tremendously difficult thing that they're setting out to do up against very difficult odds and forces. Not just the long-standing grievances that they have among themselves and that have been built up over all these years and decades of these rivalries, but also, and more importantly, the workings of the system and the ways in which, in the prisons and beyond, the authorities will try to undermine and break apart this unity and cause people to be back at each other's throats, because this is the way in which they can keep people in the conditions in which they're at, both in the prisons and out in the larger society. So this is a very important thing that people need to be aware of much more broadly, and people need to be supporting in many different ways. Or I use the example going back to the, you know, heroic rebellion in 1992 after the whole outrage of the cops who brutalized Rodney King and were caught on tape doing so, were acquitted. You know, that during and in the aftermath of that rebellion, from the first night where you saw the graffiti on the walls that said "Blacks and Mexicans together tonight," to the ways in which there were efforts to overcome the rivalries among the street gangs and to promote unity between people in different sets and people of different nationalities. There were attempts to have unity picnics, to have unity conferences, unity summits. There were real serious efforts made by a lot of the youth and others who'd been caught up in this to break out of it and do something different, reflecting an awareness on their own part that this is not the life they wanted and this is not what their, you know, their whole being, not what they wanted it to be about. This was not somehow some core of their being that could not change and that they did not want to change, but just the opposite. And these efforts were once again opposed and suppressed by the system. Time and again, unity picnics were attacked by the police and rivalries were fomented by the police and other authorities to try to break up this unity. But even more broadly and fundamentally, the program that these forces of unity came up with was calling for entrepreneurship and loans and ways in which people could get into more legitimate pursuits and businesses. And there just wasn't a basis for this within this system. And there wasn't a basis in which that could be viable. The system could not accommodate it. And so people were repressed. Their attempts were frustrated. And many people went back to doing what they've been doing before. But that doesn't mean this is what people want to be doing with their lives or the highest thing that they can aspire to and do aspire to. And that's why when we go out, this whole message of revolution resonates. And then we have to find the ways to break through. I mean, one of the things people may not be aware of is when we found very often that when we go out and take the message and the program of revolution to people and talk about fighting against, you know, mass incarceration, police brutality, blow the whistle on stop and frisk, as people did on September 13th, blow the whistle on police brutality, that many, many people, including, you know, all the way from the young 9 and 10 year old shorties to old people, you know, in the projects, are very actively supportive of this in many different ways. But we find this divide, and we've seen it again and again. We saw it in protests around the murder of Sean Bell in New York, for example, that often the young men, more than the young women, are hesitant to get involved because they're all already on probation or in some other way bound up in the so-called justice, in fact, really injustice system. And they know that if they step out, this will be used to revoke their probation or their parole or in other ways to repress them. This is a concrete chain on people that we have to find the ways to break through. It's very good that a lot of the young women are more ready to step forward. That's very good. But we also need to bring forward the young men, too, and the people broadly in the community. These are the things that we have to fight through in order to give expression to the desire that we have discovered, you know, more and more deeply is there for people to break through and have a different way. And the fact is that for the masses of these youth, and in fact for the masses of youth and people in the world, this system has no good future or alternative, but the revolution does. And we need to find the ways to work and organize people collectively, to develop the community approaches and collective approaches to helping solve the problems and dealing with and deal with the obstacles that keep people in these situations from getting actively involved in the revolution. But there's no question that there is tremendous potential there, and we have to keep working on the contradictions and on the obstacles and on the fetters that keep people from being able to give expression to their desire for a radically different world. Even as, yes, as it says in that statement you read, we have to struggle very intensely and even fiercely sometimes with people about what this is all about. That it's not just about revenge. We have to raise our sights to a whole different world and fight for a world not in which you can finally have a chance to get back at some other people. That just keeps the same thing going we've got now. You know, maybe people had a little bit better situation than you. The point of the revolution is not to, you know, be able to go after those people or even to get revenge on other people. But the point of it is to uproot and overturn this system and move forward together with people struggling for the same thing in all parts of the globe, to get to a world where all of these things that chain people down and suffocate their better aspirations no longer exist and no longer define the human condition and the life of the masses of people in the world. This is what this revolution is aiming for, and this we have to struggle to raise people's sights, even as we find the ways to break through the obstacles so that they can begin to form what we might call a critical mass of people who are turning to this revolution. Small numbers at first who step forward in different communities, neighborhoods, workplaces, schools, and so on, who are out there very boldly for this revolution and constitute an actual attractive force that then begins to change the situation where nobody thinks it's possible, everybody doesn't want to be the first to step out, to where there is a group there that has a certain coherence and force as a revolutionary pole, fighting actively against the oppression and raising people's sights so that more people then gravitate, because it's not just an individual here and an individual there, but it's actual groups of growing numbers of people who are boldly stepping out. And yes, being the first ones to step out on the line and say, we're with this revolution, at the same time as we need to go broadly and all among all sections of the people, both the people immediately in the neighborhoods and schools that people step out in, but also broadly in society to say, and to have open and public manifestations and bold manifestations among people to say, we want our youth to fight for a better world. We are proud of our youth and others who step into this revolution, and we are with them and backing them.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and you're listening today to an interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. And this interview digs into the deepest questions confronting all of us who look at the world and see what a horror it is and whose hearts ache for fundamental revolutionary change, all right, for a whole different world. This section of the interview is part 3 of 5 parts, and this section gets into where are the forces that would make this revolution, where are they going to come from? If you miss any part of this 5-part interview, you can always access it at revcom.us. That's revcom.us, or by going right up to the KPFK archives. Yeah, and that brings me to, let's revisit briefly this point about the middle class, the liberals, the progressive middle class. because, you know, it's true. What you're saying is definitely true, and including the fact that there's a role, there's an important role that middle class people have to play, progressive middle class people have to play in a movement for revolution. You know, in a revolution itself. There's an importance in terms of, you know, how do they relate to this?
I was thinking of
some things that here in this city were told to me years ago about big movie stars who made a point of opening their house so that the Panthers could meet there free of police surveillance and harassment. You know, there's these kind, and then other people who went out and actually created things and did things to change some of the fabric in society, some of the discourse, some of the atmosphere in society, which gave people room to breathe in a lot of ways. You know, and I was thinking about the situation we have right now where we have this point that you've pointed out. And I know this is a very popular, I have a friend who made a t-shirt out of this, the point about the Oedipal complex that you made, that liberals have an Oedipal complex, not that they want to sleep with their mothers, but they willfully blind themselves. And I wanted to talk about that because that too is something that's extremely, I think, bound up with this whole question of transformation and what has to be done there.
Yeah, well, the point of that is, if for those people who actually read Oedipus Rex, which I did as an English major many, many decades ago, that at the end of the drama, Oedipus actually does, you know, poke his own eyes out when he discovers the horrors of what he's been involved in. In fact, in sleeping with his own mother. But the point was that statement of mine that liberals have an Oedipal complex is the point about deliberately blinding themselves. You know, that it's not they want to sleep with their mothers, but it's they deliberately blind themselves to all the horrors that are going on and to the ways in which it can be recognized that they flow from this system. And, you know, this, you know, goes along with a statement that, one of a comrade in our party made, which I think is very insightful and very incisive and gets to something important, when they said, well, you know, a lot of people who used to know better and you came out of the 60s, for example, and were very active and radical or even thought of themselves as revolutionaries, but have since, you know, become, you know, quote unquote wiser, but actually more foolish and more, you know, have actually settled into accommodating to the system, or other people in the middle class who don't like injustices that they do see, but who don't want to get out of their comfort zone to struggle against it. That for these people, this comrade said, the attack on revolution, the attack on communism, the attack on the Cultural Revolution, on Mao, you know, and all that, has had the, you know, has provided the framework in which these people can say, with regard to fighting against the injustices and going up against the system that perpetrates and enforces these injustices, the attitude that, as his comrade put it, the way these people think is, I'm so glad that it turned out that the right thing to do about all this is to do nothing at all. And I think this does capture where a lot of people have retreated into, and it does have to do with this point of then at the same time, in order to remain in your comfort zone, willfully blinding yourself. But at the same time, you know, our whole approach is to build a broad united front, including people from the different sections of the middle class, to unite with them in ways in which, you know, whether it's the Occupy movement or which was involved others in the middle class, but was to a significant degree, you know, made up of people from the different sections of the middle class, or people who are moving around the environment, or people who do protest the torture and war. There are far too few, but there are some. Or other forms in which people do question, dissent, criticize, and even rebel or resist or protest. It's very important to unite with that among all sections of the people, including in the middle class, while at the same time we recognize that the core, the leading and driving force of this revolution is not going to come out of the middle class, but it's going to come out of the people who most desperately need this revolution and have much less, if any, of a comfort zone to retreat into. So that's an important point there. Now, but the fact is that you are never going to have a revolution in which only the people who are most desperate are striving for that revolution. They have to have allies, and they have to have forces that they're able to unite with more broadly in society. More particularly, you're never going to have a revolution without a vibrant and increasingly radical student movement, which is going up against the injustices, including the unjust wars of the system, and in which is, you know, raising the big questions and debating the big questions, and which is developing a culture, as we say, a culture of radical revolt against this revolting culture that spews forth from and dominates, you know, in this society, spews forth from the system, reinforces it, and spreads its ugliness throughout the society as a whole in many different forms. So all these are very important elements of building a movement for revolution. And in more particularly, you do need people who are willing to, you know, who are in the intelligentsia, who, you know, people who do work with ideas, whose ideas can influence other people in a disproportionate way because they are concentrating thinking and spreading its influence out in society. You do need a section of the intelligentsia to, as it's been put, transfer its allegiance from the present system and the present ruling class to the cause of the oppressed and to the cause of revolution and of communism. And this, you know, is going to win over a section of the intelligentsia in today's conditions. This was a mass phenomenon, as you know, back in the 1960s. And, you know, I wouldn't even be sitting here talking about revolution and communism if this hadn't happened at that time through the influence of the Vietnamese people's struggle and black people's struggle in the U.S. and then how this in turn gave rise to a growing women's movement and a gay rights movement and liberation movement and so on and so forth. But this, under today's conditions, is being suffocated by what we've been talking about at various points today, which is the not only the changing conditions where there isn't out in the world a vibrant and inspiring alternative as there was when we came forward back in the 1960s in China and the Cultural Revolution, when that has been overthrown and reversed there in China, but also when there's been this relentless ideological assault and, as I put it, a campaign of ideological revenge against what was represented by China and the Cultural Revolution and against revolution and communism in general. So it's more difficult. And it's also, there's been this whole dumbing down in the society where the educational system has been increasingly geared not to developing people who think critically and challenge things, but just people who know how to take tests and try to prepare themselves to get a job in a world where it's increasingly hard to get a job and where students are burdened with tremendous debt. All these things are weighing on students and lowering their sights and people in the intelligentsia more broadly. But still we have, there is a basis, there is a potential, and we have to fight through to win in waves growing numbers of people among the intelligentsia who can contribute to the movement for revolution and contribute to the core of communist leadership that's needed for that revolution, both by helping to counter the slanders that are being heaped and the abuse and distortion that's being heaped on the experience of the communist revolution, but also to popularize the new synthesis of communism that's been brought forward and is embodied in my body of work. And beyond that, and at the same time, also helping to address and solve the theoretical and strategic problems of the revolution. Because we have developed a basic, in our party, a basic strategic approach to making revolution, yes, in this country, and actually to fighting through and winning when the time comes. But that is precisely that. It is a strategic conception and approach. There is a tremendous amount of work that has to be done to continually deal with and overcome the contradictions and obstacles that get posed in the way of actually building that movement for revolution and actually wielding and uniting all the different forces that have to be part of that revolution and enabling it to all go in the direction toward revolution where it needs to go. There's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done to solve the problems, including as they arise in the realm of theory and strategy. It's like Lenin said, theory is extremely important, and we should never downgrade the importance of theory and of working with ideas, which is all too often done in this society with its sort of rank pragmatism and widespread Philistinism. We should never downgrade the importance of theory and working with ideas and the intellectual ferment of all different kinds. You're never going to have a revolution without that, and the kind of revolution you could have, even if you could make a revolution without that kind of intellectual ferment and artistic creativity and so on, would not lead to anything really radically different and better. So we need that. But at the same time, as Lenin said, theory, as important as it is, he was actually quoting Goethe, if I'm not mistaken, the German poet Goethe. He said, taking that statement from Goethe, Lenin said, theory is gray, but green is a tree of life, which is a way not of saying that theory is not important and intellectual work and working with ideas and developing strategy, developing what we call line, that is, an outlook, a method, and its concrete application to develop program and strategy and tactics and policies to actually build the movement for revolution. All that kind of work in the realm of ideas and theory is very important, but life is always more complex than you anticipate. So there's continual work both to carry forward with enriching and developing the theory, but also to solve the practical problems that arise in carrying out the theory in line to actually deal with the greenery of life and the complexity of life and the struggle to change the world.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and you've just been listening to part 3 of a 5-part interview I conducted with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. This part dealt with the forces for revolution. Where are the people that are going to make this revolution? Where are they going to come from? We got 2 more parts in the series, and if you miss any of this, any of the segments of this interview, you can always access it here at the KPFK archives or by going to revcom.us. That's revcom.us, all right? So don't miss any of it.